Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. The United States of America imprisons its people at a rate unique in the entire world. While we make up only about 5% of the global population, we hold nearly one quarter of all prisoners in the world, which is an astonishing statistic. Today on the New Yorker Radio Hour, we're talking about mass incarceration and how a movement against mass incarceration took shape. And to do that, I've invited WNYC's Kai Wright to join me for today's show. Kai hosts the program The United States of Anxiety. So, Kai, you've been thinking about this problem for a long time. Please help me understand some of the numbers on this, because they are staggering.
They really are, and you've given us some of them already. But, I mean, for many Americans, it's funny to think that we can recite these by rote at this point. There are 1 in 5 people in the United States who have a criminal record. 1 in 5. That's a fifth of the population. There are about 7 million people in the system in some way, if you add up parole and jail and prison and all of that. And, of course, 2/3 of those people are Black or Latinx.
Now, does any country come close to the United States in these numbers?
Absolutely not. And I don't know. I think you can probably say that no country ever has come close to these numbers. And it's also a thing to remember that we never came close to these numbers until very recent history. I mean, this was a problem that began in the
80s. We didn't back into this accidentally. It happened as a result of politics at a certain point in time. How did that happen?
In the 1980s, when we began the war on drugs. And the 70s were a period of great upheaval in many places in the United States, culturally, politically, economically. And we came out of that period with a lot of agita. And as the Reagan era began, from Washington all the way through municipal governments, there became this idea that the people are out of control and we have to police them more aggressively.
So, Kai, when did you first start hearing about the idea, maybe not in this phrase, but mass incarceration as an issue? As a political issue.
The thing is it's quite a modern idea as well, right? I mean, I encourage people to read James Forman Jr.'s book, Locking Up Our Own, because it's an important reminder that this was we had widespread social agreement, Black and white, left and right, about the idea of a carceral state at one point. This was a mainstream idea that we should be tough on crime.
And it's worth saying that right now we beat up politicians quite rightly for their role in the crime bill in the mid-90s. Just to remind ourselves and remind everybody, how did the 1994 crime bill lead to the situation that we're now in?
It is hard to point to a single piece of legislation that was more massive in its impact and the breadth of the things it touched. But the two main things that it did was that it pumped lots of money into local police departments and encouraged them, created incentives for more aggressive policing, which meant now a lot more people are touching the criminal justice system. And then secondly, it increased the penalty for people once they were there. So people are serving longer sentences for more trifling crimes. The way to understand it is that it took the system and it just pumped steroids into all of the prosecutorial parts of it, and the system ballooned as a consequence.
But there really was broad agreement, and there were a lot of African-American politicians and people in the African-American community and conservatives and liberals and whites and all the rest who were deeply concerned about street crime, drugs, didn't know what to do about it, and poured all their energies into this bill that turned out to be a national disaster,
the 1994 crime bill. And the idea of being tough on crime, this was a mainstream idea. And it was not until really the last decade where we started to see a sudden shift in mainstream political people, both in the Black community and outside the Black community, start to say, this is a problem.
Well, you were at a NAACP conference, I think it was in 2009, where you heard Ben Jealous, who was the head of the NAACP at that time, talking about this. And it was quite revelatory.
It was really a big moment in this history.
What happened?
I mean, so this is 2009. It's a year after Barack Obama is elected. And it's important to remember that context, right? Like, everybody was ready to be post-racial. Black people were euphoric. Everybody was ready to turn the page. And the NAACP itself is a mainline civil rights organization. Civil rights never included a criminal justice platform. Civil rights was about jobs and housing.
Equal access.
It was not about criminal justice reform. And Ben Jealous, not a preacher, not a politician.
So Ben Jealous gets up and says what?
The youngest person ever to lead the NAACP. And he gets up and he says, we need a new agenda. We need to start thinking not just about rights, but about justice. And justice includes all of these more complicated things, most importantly, criminal justice reform.
Was there a big response in the room, by the way, to Ben Jealous?
No. Not at the time.
It seemed to fall on deaf ears?
I wouldn't say fall on deaf ears, but people, he did not rouse the crowd with this.
No kidding.
It was not, you know, and this is a room full of, this is the 100-year anniversary of this organization. It is full of middle age and up church people, you know,
sure,
who are frankly socially conservative.
The old civil rights establishment.
Absolutely.
Right. So how did that idea start filtering out, whether it was the Black community or beyond?
Well, what happened was Ben Jealous comes out, starts saying that. Michelle Alexander writes a book that says we have to fundamentally rethink about this.
And in fact, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, which came out in 2010, didn't make a big impact for another couple of years after that.
Well, not broadly, but within the circles of people who were thinking about this stuff, people who were thinking about racial justice and civil rights already, this book and Ben Jealous and a few other thinkers, they started to reshape the conversation.
I'm talking today with WNYC's Kai Wright, who's the host of the program The United States of Anxiety. We mentioned Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, which has really been one of the most influential books of the last decade, and it spent 5 years or so on the bestseller list. Alexander helped a lot of people understand mass incarceration as an issue of social justice. Cornel West called The New Jim Crow a grand wake-up call in the midst of a long slumber of indifference to the poor and vulnerable. I spoke with Michelle Alexander at the start of 2020 before the pandemic, the presidential election, and the killing of George Floyd. Alexander is currently a professor at Union Theological Seminary. When The New Jim Crow came out a decade ago, you said that you wrote it for the person I was 10 years ago. So take me back to those times, to that Michelle Alexander and the work you were doing for the ACLU. What were you finding out?
So that would have been 20 years ago from today. And back during those years, I was working as a civil rights lawyer, and I was well aware that there was bias in our criminal justice system and that bias pervaded all of our political, social, and economic systems. That's why I was a civil rights lawyer. But what I didn't understand was that a new system of racial and social control had been born again in America, a system eerily reminiscent to those that we had left behind. In fact, you know, I was heading to work my first day at the ACLU directing the Racial Justice Project when I happened to notice a sign posted to a telephone pole that said in large, bold print, "The drug war is the new Jim Crow." And I remember thinking to myself, yeah, the criminal justice system is racist in a lot of ways, but doesn't help to make comparisons to Jim Crow. People just think you're crazy. And then I hopped on the bus and headed to my new job. So it was really as a result of representing victims of racial profiling and police brutality that I had a series of experiences that began, you know, what I've come to call my awakening.
Yeah, what was that awakening like? What were you seeing in a very specific way in your work that where the scales were falling from your eyes in a way?
Well, there were a number of incidents. You know, partly it was beginning to collect data and coming to see how the police were behaving in radically different ways in poor communities of color than they were in middle class, white or suburban communities. I mean, this wasn't a shock to me in any way, but the scale of it was astonishing. You know, seeing rows of black men lined up against walls being frisked and handcuffed and arrested for extremely minor crimes like loitering or vagrancy or possession of tiny amounts of marijuana. But there was one incident in particular, and it involved a young African-American man who walked into my office one day and forever changed the way I viewed myself as a civil rights lawyer and the system I was up against. He walked in my office carrying a stack of papers a couple of inches thick. He had taken detailed notes of his encounters with the police. And at the time, I was interviewing people for a possible class action suit against the Oakland Police Department. And I thought, wow, maybe we have finally found our dream plaintiff. Maybe this is the one we've been looking for. And then he says something that makes me pause. And I said, did you just say you're a drug felon? And we knew we couldn't put someone on the stand if they had a felony record because we'd be exposing them to cross-examination about their prior criminal history and turning it into a mini trial about a young man's criminal past rather than the police conduct. And so I'm looking at him saying, okay, you're a drug felon? And he gets very quiet and says, yeah. I'm a drug felon, but let me tell you what happened. And he starts telling me this long story about how he'd been framed and drugs had been planted on him. And he becomes more and more agitated and upset. And then finally, he becomes enraged and he says, what's to become of me? What's to become of me? Mm-hmm. And he starts explaining that he had just taken the plea because he was afraid of doing the time and that, they told him that if he just took the plea, he could just walk right out with just felony probation. And he said, but what's to become of me? He's like, I can't get a job anywhere because of my felony record. He's like, do you understand? I have to sleep in my grandma's basement at night because I can't even get into public housing with a drug felony. He's like, how am I supposed to take care of myself? How am I supposed to take care of myself as a man? He's like, I can't even feed myself. He was like, do you know I can't even get food stamps because of my drug felony? He says, good luck finding one young black man in my neighborhood they haven't gotten to yet. They've gotten to us all already.
How conscious was that? How would you argue that it was a conscious decision to establish a successor, in a sense, to Jim Crow and what came before Jim Crow?
Well, there were mixed motives. And, you know, one of the things that I laid out in the book was the history of the Southern strategy, the deliberate political strategy of divide and conquer, of using get tough racial appeals in order to appeal to poor and working class whites, particularly in the South, who were fearful of and resentful of the progress that had been made by African Americans since the Civil Rights Movement. That Southern strategy was in part about turning the clock back on racial progress. So the drug war was in part a politically motivated strategy, a backlash to the civil rights movement, but it was also a reflection of conscious and unconscious biases fueled by media portrayals of drug users. And those racial stereotypes were resonant with the same stereotypes of slaves and folks during the Jim Crow era.
Michelle, some of the scholars that have been in dialogue with you about your book have taken issue with your focus on the war on drugs and nonviolent drug offenses. John Pfaff, in his book Locked In, says that only about 16% of state prisoners are serving time on drug charges, and very few of them, maybe about 5 or 6% of that group, are both low-level and nonviolent.
It is true that roughly half of the people who are held in state prisons today have been convicted of offenses that are labeled violent. But one of the main points of the new Jim Crow, what I hoped to get across, was that the system of mass incarceration is not simply about who is behind bars at any particular moment. It is this much larger system, mm-hmm. a system that begins when a young person is swept off the street for a minor, nonviolent drug offense like possession of marijuana, branded a criminal or felon, and then released into a permanent second-class status. There are twice as many people on probation or parole today than are locked in prisons or jails. Twice as many. And that is the new Jim Crow.
Now, there's been a lot of energy around criminal justice reform and attempts to change the system. But one of the big roadblocks has been the fact that a huge number of prisons, 70% in fact, are located in rural communities and go a long way toward bolstering the economies of those places.
Yes. The profit motive is significant. And very often people think about the profit motive simply in terms of private prisons making money off of caging human beings. However, you know, as the book Prison Profiteers points out, there is a very large range of corporate interests, private interests that make enormous amount of money off of our prison system. You know, everything from private healthcare providers to taser gun manufacturers to, companies that are now creating these electronic monitors.
Decarceration, you call it.
Yes. This is one of the most concerning developments to me, the emergence of the system of e-carceration or digital prisons, as many activists now call them, where people are now being forced to wear electronic monitors, GPS tracking devices, and it will be cheaper to surveil and control millions of people electronically than through old-fashioned brick-and-mortar prisons.
What do you say to people who argue that these technological solutions are somehow more humane than prisons and jails?
Well, certainly most people, myself included, would rather have an electronic monitor, a GPS tracking device attached to my ankle than to be sitting in a literal cage. However, I find it very difficult to call a system of e-carceration and the emergence of digital prisons as progress. Progress would be decriminalizing our communities. Massive investments in education, in drug treatment, in healthcare, in trauma support. That's what our communities need and deserve, not new high-tech means of monitoring, surveillance, and control for larger and larger segments of our population.
Finally, I hope you don't mind if I ask what seems to be a personal professional question. Your main teaching post has been at an institution that has religion and faith at its center, the Union Theological Seminary. Does that choice represent a change in your thinking on criminal justice or in your own life?
As I see it, the crisis of mass incarceration is not simply a legal or political problem to be solved, but it's a profound spiritual and moral crisis as well. And I think ultimately these questions of what does it mean to be in right relationship to one another? Who belongs in a community, in a nation? How should we treat the least advantaged? How do we repair harm in a constructive and responsible way?
Are these questions at the center of a next book?
Yeah, they are. I'm working on a book that is very different from The New Jim Crow. It's much more personal and is about my journey going from a liberal civil rights lawyer who was tinkering with the machine to someone who now believes that much more revolutionary change is required, but it's not simply a political revolution. A moral and spiritual revolution is also required of us now.
Michelle Alexander, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, originally published in 2010. Our conversation first aired last year. We're taking the entire hour today to look at the past and the future of mass incarceration. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Over a decade ago, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, opened a lot of people's eyes to mass incarceration as a failing of social justice. Today, we're rebroadcasting an entire hour from 2020 looking at the state of mass incarceration. And I'm joined by Kai Wright, the host of WNYC's program, The United States of Anxiety. Kai, a while ago, you spoke with the writer and poet Reginald Dwayne Betts. How do you guys know each other?
Well, we met while I was making a previous podcast called Caught, which was a look at the juvenile justice system through the lens of the kids in it. And Dwayne really walked us through that system together.
What was his story?
He, at age 16 in Maryland, he went with a group of friends to a mall. A guy came out of a mall, got in his car, and they put a gun to his temple and carjacked him. And it was, Dwayne tells the story that he decided to hold the gun because he was scared what would happen if somebody else had it. But he nonetheless put the gun to this guy's temple, and they got caught. And he was locked up for 9 years, many of it spent in solitary confinement.
What happened when he got out?
Well, he got out. He became a lawyer. That was itself a journey because he has a criminal conviction, and that was something that he had to overcome in order to pass the bar and be admitted in Connecticut. And he became an author, a very celebrated author. He wrote a memoir and a number of books of poetry. Most recently, he has published a book called Felon. And so I sat down with Reginald Dwayne Betts. We started with him reading a poem called Essay on Reentry. And in this poem, he's telling his young son about his past and admitting that he'd been in prison.
Essay on Reentry. At 2 a.m., without enough spirit spilling into my liver to know to keep my mouth shut, my youngest learned of years I spent inside a box, a spell, a kind of incantation I was under. Not whiskey, but history. I robbed a man. This months before he would drop bucket after bucket on opposing players. The entire bedraggled bunch, 5 and 6, and he leaping as if every layup erases something. That's how I saw it. My screaming, coaching, sweating presence recompense for the pen. My father has never seen me play ball as part of this. My oldest knew. Told of my crimes by a stranger. Tell me we aren't running towards failure is what I want to ask my sons. But it is 2 a.m. The oldest has gone off to dream in the comfort of his room. The youngest, despite him seeming more lucid than me, just reflects cartoons back from his eyes. So when he tells me, Daddy, it's okay, I know what's happening. It's some scraggling angel lost from his pack finding a way to fulfill his duty. Lending words to this kid who crawls into my arms wanting more the stories of my prison, the sleep that he fought while I held court at a bar, with men who knew that when the drinking was done, the drinking wouldn't make the stories we brought home any easier to tell.
Mm. Can you tell me about that conversation? What was this poem about?
Yeah, so it was wild, right? So I don't think I ever told anybody this story. A few months before, like the summertime, before I got admitted to the bar, I was on the phone talking to somebody that was locked up, and my youngest son heard me say something or something, and he came down. And he was like, "Did you just say you was in jail?" I was like, "Nah, I didn't just say that. I had absolutely just said that, right?"
Because you had kept it from him.
I had kept it from him, but I guess I don't even think I had said that, but I said something that allowed him to infer that I had been locked up, right? And I finally get admitted to the bar. So after I get sworn in, you know, I turn around, I look at my mom. My wife is there, my sons are there, my grandmother's there, my uncle's there, my aunt is there. Like, the same people who were in court when I got sentenced were there. And I said, you know, the last time I was in a court like this, I was sentenced to 9 years in prison. My youngest son gets up, sits on his brother's lap, whispers something in his ear, and I'm like, oh, damn. I really just told him. So afterwards, you know, we had a party, but I stayed out late, though. I probably came in at like 2 a.m. And then in this poem is what happens next.
Why had you been reluctant to tell him in the first place?
I mean, when do you introduce that kind of knowledge to somebody? My oldest, Makai, he once told me, "Dad, you know, I'm not like my classmates." And I was thinking, shit, why not? I mean, I got a Yale law degree. You know, like, I don't understand what you mean. And I was like, your mama got an advanced degree, too. You know, I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, we some, like, degree black folks, yes. Right? What do you mean you not like your classmates? And he's like, well, you know, they didn't have to learn when they were 5 that their dad went to jail. And I just hadn't, you know, and this is my oldest.
Yeah.
And I just hadn't thought about the fact that that was a, I mean, it sounds naive, really, to be like, I hadn't thought about the fact that that was a thing. Because I knew it was a thing when it happened. And he was crying, and I had to talk to him. And
yeah.
That's why I was reluctant. I thought I might be able to save my youngest son something. I don't know. You know, like, I might get pardoned or something. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to hold off until, like, something happens that makes it more palatable. You know, like, I mean, you don't ever want your children to feel bad for you, right? It's right. Like, that ain't what you're in the world for. Like, you're not in the world to hurt for me. You know, I'm good. I'm supposed to help deal with whatever pain that you have to experience in this world. I'm supposed to protect you from all of that pain. I'm not supposed to, like, add to it in this way.
Well, your record almost kept you from becoming a lawyer in Connecticut. I wonder if you can tell me about that. You got a letter from the Connecticut Bar Examining Committee that said you had to prove your, quote, good character before you could be admitted. What?
Yeah, that was, you know, it's wild, too, man. It's like I had to prove my character and fitness, and it's, that was one of the struggles, but also the struggle was just recognizing, again, I'm being reminded that, okay, how fast you run, you're not going to outpace the collateral consequences of a criminal conviction. And you will not run fast enough where that thing won't still be in your orbit. And that's what it reminded me of. It also reminded me of something else, made me aware of something else that, you know, I had to get these letters, right?
Yeah.
You get letters from friends, and it was a blessing to get all of these letters because it showed how many people supported me. But it was kind of tragic to feel like they had to put all of that on display for a body that should have admitted me on GP.
Yeah.
You know, and it makes me think about what does it mean if you, because I'm like gregarious, I'm like loud, you know, I'm like in the mix. But what if I was like an introvert, you know, like I'm like an introvert, extrovert. But what if I was like an introvert and I didn't make these friendships, not because I didn't want to, but because I didn't know how to, you know. What would it have meant if I hadn't written 4 books? Because I could say I hadn't been hiding from prison. I mean, look, I just wrote all of these books about it.
Right.
But what if I hadn't necessarily been hiding, but I just didn't want to make my life a long conversation about incarceration? I might not have gotten admitted. And that is...
You shouldn't have to be exceptional.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I'm exceptional. But, right, you shouldn't have to be exceptional, you know. I'm decent. I got a nice jump shot, but
it's hard to avoid a sense of hopelessness, I guess isn't really the word, but it feels a little hopeless in some of these poems. They're such heavy circumstances, and I know that's quite the opposite of how you feel about the work. How do we deal with the grim reality of this emotionally, thinking about the future and how we move forward?
Well, I would first, though, argue that maybe it's not as hopeless as like, even Essay on Reentry. You know, I'm there. You got a poem in which the speaker is a father who is grappling with telling his child that he was incarcerated, but the speaker is also a coach. The speaker is also figuring out ways to talk to his son about this really difficult thing. The speaker is actually thinking that it matters, and clearly he has some friends who he could talk to. You know, even the one about a for bail denied, I mean, I still think a poem that centers a mother's pain and says, like, this mother is watching this, right? And she said, I'm going to be a voice of protest in this moment. It's actually also something hopeful because when I got locked up, people weren't even having this conversation, right? And I know that when I got locked up, in the era of 16-year-old teenagers, 15-year-old kids, 17-year-old kids being called super predator, there was nobody. Like, Bernie Sanders could say whatever he want about what he felt about the crime bill, but I will say that nobody was standing up and saying, listen, this is my child. This is somebody in my community. And yes, we need to deal with violence and we need to address violence, but you will not talk about my children this way. Mm. And so I feel like, you know, these poems try to point those things out. And I think that's the hopefulness, right? I think that these poems are a series of occasions in which you got a man trying to figure out how to save himself. It's a collection of these men, you know, telling these stories. And they say that, you know, I am somebody here and I deserve to be seen.
Duane, thank you for this collection and for your work.
Thank you. Thank you, man. I appreciate it. Yeah, it's cool.
Reginald Duane Betts, talking with WNYC's Kai Wright early last year. Betts' collection of poems is called Felon. You can hear him read another poem called On Voting for Barack Obama in a Nat Turner T-shirt at NewYorkerRadio.org. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It's been over a decade since Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, became a bestseller. The book identified mass incarceration not as a good solution to crime, but as part of a much larger problem. People concerned about social justice and people concerned about the size of government both started to pay attention. As public sentiment has shifted, reform has come in fits and starts. For example, in 2018, Florida restored voting rights to former felons in a referendum. But the following year, the state legislature undermined that right. The biggest piece of federal legislation in the last few years has been the First Step Act, a bipartisan bill signed by President Trump that released some 3,000 people from prison and reduced sentences for many others. One of the people released under the First Step Act is a man we're going to call Jonathan. Our producer, Kalalia, started meeting with him shortly after he got out. This piece originally aired in January 2020.
Jonathan was released from a federal prison in Orlando. He caught a bus to New York, where his mother is living. Before getting on, Jonathan bought his first smartphone.
When I got on the bus, I went to the back of the bus, and I got the phone, and I ordered the Last Avenger movie.
And as long as there are those that remember what was, there will always be those that are unable to accept what can be.
And I was watching it, and that's how I kind of collapsed my time like I was in a cell. I got in a corner and watched that movie.
Because now, I know what I must do.
A man sat next to him and started talking, but Jonathan wasn't ready to make small talk.
I said, look, man, I just got home. I don't know anything. I don't know what's going on. I'm trying to figure this phone out. I was really trying to shake off the prison feeling, and the prison feeling was hard to shake off. It's still there with me.
This last prison stint was Jonathan's third. The charges weren't violent, but because of previous convictions, he served 17 years for possession of drugs and an illegal firearm. All told, Jonathan spent 25 years behind bars. And now, as a middle-aged man, he's starting life all over again. When he got to New York City, he had one day to report to his probation officer. About 6 weeks after his release, I met him in downtown Brooklyn.
How you doing?
I'm all right.
Feeling sorry to bit. Keep you waiting. Cool. Were you in the rain? Oh, my God.
No, I'm not in the rain. I'm just being this is where I want to be.
Okay.
In the rain.
You're on your phone?
I'm trying to get a bill person.
A bill person?
This is what I would like to be doing right now.
What?
Paying bills.
Really?
Yes.
It's fine. You like being in the rain. You like paying bills.
When you haven't done any of these things in a while, they're a blessing to you. People look at it as, you know, mundane, or to be able just to make it, pay a bill is, because where I was, I didn't have any bills. You know what I mean? I was in prison.
Yeah.
And the rain issue, you know, it's either you went out in the rain, walked in a circle, or stayed in the unit. So now, I'm out. Look, there's so much to do in the rain. You can go to a store. You can go to Statue. You can go anywhere you want. And there's something to do.
A couple of days later, I went with Jonathan to a group he attends. They're trying to help formerly incarcerated people like him find work in construction. The session is led by a man named Divine Shabazz, and he starts with a warning.
Right? So I can't assist you without forewarning you that construction is a hostile environment. A lot of people in there are ex-offenders. A lot of people in construction are from the street. A lot of people, college dropouts, you know, addicts, you name it. Because in construction, they don't discriminate. It's important that we have this class. So y'all know what you're getting into, and so that you can have a strategy going in, like, okay.
It's mostly about finding jobs, but a lot of the conversation is about building life skills and coping with the world outside of prison.
My question is, what's the difference between aggressive and assertive?
Okay, aggressive is when they both are fueled by the same thing. Assertively is when you're standing up for yourself. Identifying the way that they make you feel. Like, you just, they made me feel like I'm not a man. They made me feel like less than a man. They made me feel like a punk. They made me feel like whatever it is, identifying whatever that feeling is, and then being able to communicate that to that person.
Mm-hmm. When I went in, I was about 170. I was slim. You know what I mean? I was a small dude. You know what I mean? So, you know, I just had a lot of heart and wouldn't stop. So my thing was, I got to catch this guy. How am I going to catch this guy? All right. First chance I see him going in his cell without his cellie, I'm going right behind him and deal with the circumstances. So my thing was more so not to have a conflict resolution. It was just more so about a conflict, but get it to my advantage.
A few days later, we met at the headquarters of the fire department. To get a union construction job, Jonathan needs to get a few certifications.
Small things as far as the numbers, like how far something's supposed to be placed, how, you know, weight, how much the hose can take, which is like 350 PSIA.
Mm-hmm.
Under that.
This morning, He's going to take a test for something called an S-92.
If you are here to take a test, have your application and employers let, oh, I got to go up there with this application and give it to them.
Right, and then they'll get a number probably.
Okay. I mean, before I go up there, I don't want to rush up there.
Well, let's see what number they're at. Jonathan's number is called, and he goes off to take the test. Jonathan really wants to get a construction job quickly, so he can start saving money to get his own place. His mom says that he can stay as long as he needs, but she's overly protective of him and worries all the time that he'll go back to prison. This makes Jonathan anxious. Jonathan was very little when his mother and stepfather immigrated from Guyana in the late 70s.
My family, when we first come to this country, where we were on welfare and public assistance and all that, eventually, it changed. We started, you know, my family, they started working in Citibank and started getting a little bit more money. And then things changed. We went to Delaware. We had a different style of life. You know what I mean? We had a middle-class style life.
And as he grew older, he started having issues with his stepfather.
I don't know if it's because I was the older or not his or whatever the circumstances, I never got to find out. It was always my fault. Beatings were part of normal way of life for family to deal with discipline. Who's to say what's right and wrong, you know what I mean? But we do know when it becomes more of abuse than actual discipline.
His family's solution to the tension and his acting out was to send him to Brooklyn to live with his aunt and her family. On the day after Christmas, we went to see his Aunt Elizabeth in East Flatbush. It wasn't even 10 o'clock in the morning, but she insisted I try some stew.
Get a fork.
So this is like really the butt of an ox?
The tail of an ox.
Yeah. What do you think?
Like short ribs.
It does have, I do have short ribs in the pot.
Okay.
We add that together with our spices, right?
Do you remember when you first heard that he was coming out?
I was in Barbados on vacation. When I came back, I got a phone call saying, "Hi, Auntie Elizabeth." And I was like, "Who's this?" The voice, you know. And he said, it's me, you forget I lived in your home." And then I said, "My nephew." I was so excited, I started to cry.
What was it like when you first heard that he was going to prison and that he was doing things in the street?
I was shocked, surprised, because I didn't see that coming, because he wasn't that type of person, you know. Mm-hmm. Things happen, you know, God is good. He survived whatever it is that he went through, and he's out now, and I'm happy for him.
Jonathan's aunt says she didn't know he had been in trouble as a kid, but it was her ex-husband who got him into it.
Well, my uncle, he was a hustler, a gambler, drug dealer, and he was known around. These guys got these cars, they got the money, they got the girls, they got everything. Everybody's falling over him.
For his 12th birthday, his uncle gave him a gold rope necklace, the kind of chains that many dealers wore.
I had the chain and I just felt so like, this is what I want to do. Guy might be saying, "Hey man, I need you to go to Coney Island and drop off a package." Because they trust you and you want them to trust you. You know what I mean? They're giving you opportunities and then it grows into different things, more responsibilities. That's when I really kind of like was caught up into the rapture of street life.
I keep thinking about something Jonathan told me. When he stopped going to school, no one bothered to call looking for him, at least as far as he knows. The authority figures either ignored him or, like his uncle, led him towards trouble. It seems only the police paid attention. Now, at 46, he's applying for jobs for the very first time.
He's going to fax the letter of recommendation to the FDNY. And I will be getting the card in a few.
Back at the fire department, Jonathan has some good news.
So this is the certificate of passing.
That's great. Congratulations. How do you feel?
I felt like I won $1,000,000. I've never really done anything like this in my entire life. So now I have something of value that I actually did on my own without having to shortcut or try to do something illegal to obtain means and methods.
While waiting for his new certification to come through, Jonathan shows me his new phone.
Yeah, way more apps than I have.
I had more. I just took off a bunch of them. They were dating site apps. So.
Dating site apps?
Yeah, I was trying to find a high-standard woman.
Good luck with that.
I'm going to take this off, too, because...
Tinder?
Yeah, I didn't get no hit. I get some matches.
Well, let me see your profile. You don't even have a photo.
I got a profile up there.
Oh.
You see?
Can you read it to me?
Just come home from a long stretch in prison and is looking for any woman interested in whatever, wherever, whenever.
No, you don't put that. I would skip over you too if I read just came home from a long...
I just put that there.
You
I just
can't
put
write that.
That. I'm being honest. I'm keeping things up front with people. So if they choose to, they choose to. If they don't, they don't.
Why do you have 26?
26 to 45.
That's too young.
Okay.
You need an older woman.
No, I want to have kids.
Okay, it's in 30.
Okay.
30. I would go, because 26 is too young.
I have to find a particular woman that can understand my situation, because I don't want to get into a situation where it becomes so complex that she possibly can send me back to jail by an argument. Oh, she calls the police. I have to like think about 9 times before I do things. It's hard to approach people because I'm so guarded, because I don't want to go back.
Dating feels dangerous to Jonathan now. So does going to a job site. And even his family feel like strangers to him.
I don't know them. You know, they're my family, but how do you know a person that hasn't been in your life 25 years? Right now, we're building a bond. You know what I mean? We're getting to know each other and our habits. I don't know my family. I don't know my mother. I don't know my sister. I don't know my brother. I don't know their kids. I don't know anybody. I walked around the neighborhood today. I didn't see one person I knew.
The world is a scary place for someone in his position. But for New Year's Eve, he's determined to enjoy life to the fullest. He makes the long trip on his own to Times Square to see the ball drop for the first time in his life. There was no way that I was going out in the cold around all of those people. So I showed Jonathan how to record on his smartphone, and I wished him a wonderful night.
It's a few minutes, and here it goes. I'm here, I'm getting ready. 1 minute left.
Selfie time. No more recording. Bye, good night. Happy New Year.
Jonathan got that construction job and has had consistent work for the past 2 years. Not long ago, he found an apartment of his own, and he's dating a woman who he met in person, not online. And they see each other pretty regularly. Although he wants children, he's still taking things slow. Jonathan spoke with Kalalia, a producer for the New Yorker Radio Hour, in 2020. I'm here with WNYC's Kai Wright, who's co-hosting today's program about mass incarceration. Kai, long sentences like the one Jonathan received are all part of the reason that the prison population just exploded in this country starting around 1980. How did we come to decide that the point of prison wasn't correction or rehabilitation, but basically warehousing millions of people? And what have we learned from this experience?
I wish I could tell you an answer to either question, David. I mean, the thing is, what is clear is that we decided somewhere along the way that it was okay to just put people out of sight and not think about them. And, you know, for many of us who have those folks in our families, they weren't out of sight, right? But for a lot of Americans, it was fine to just ignore.
Where has there been progress in prison reform?
Ooh.
I'll let you think for a few minutes.
Where Has there been progress? That is not a question I'm prepared to answer because I don't know. I think where people see hope are in a few places. One, you know, are some of these sort of ways in which we're rolling back the drug war, right? So there has been some sentencing reform, and there does seem to be consensus on the need for continued sentencing reform. There is now a strong and important movement around bail reform and getting rid of this idea that people who, because they're poor, just sit and languish in jails. There has been a lot of energy around changing how prosecutors operate. So we're seeing now suddenly that running for prosecutor is a thing that reformers do. It used to be like
in Philadelphia and
like
San Francisco.
In Philadelphia and San Francisco and other places. In New York here. Political debate and prosecutorial campaigns are now about who is appropriately reformed. But more broadly than that, David, is there's been a change in the politic of this, even in the movement. And this idea of prison abolition, which used to be, you know, something that was confined to the far left of the movement, is now an increasingly mainstream idea that we have to figure out how to stop sweeping people into the criminal justice system at all and find a new way to figure out what we do when we do harm to one another.
Kai, this has been terrific, and thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Kai Wright is the host of WNYC's The United States of Anxiety. Earlier this fall, bipartisan talks for a sweeping criminal justice reform package collapsed in the Senate. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Thanks so much for listening today, and join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
With additional help from Priscilla Alabi and Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.